This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Coming up, we'll discuss what net neutrality means for the cable and media industry with Western Michigan University professor Rick Gershon. But first, the Kalamazoo Community Foundation is implementing a new strategic plan to develop its work in the community over the next few years. We're going to discuss what that focus is and what that could mean for the Kalamazoo area. Carrie Pickett-Irway is the president of the Kalamazoo Community Foundation. Thank you for being here.
It's my pleasure.
And Supratik Stotz-Ghosh is the vice president for community investment with the Kalamazoo Community Foundation. Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's take people inside here for just a little bit before we talk about what you're actually looking to do. How does a community foundation actually work? How do you determine what areas you're going to focus on?
Well, speaking about the strategic planning process and determining our priorities, that's actually a very comprehensive process for Kalamazoo. The way that we do it is a way that really includes the voice of the community and does significant environmental scanning. So we start our strategic planning process with a scan of the environment, our local environment, any issues that are specific to our field, community philanthropy, and also the national environment, looking at best practices. We take that information in the form of research and data, and then we turn to our community. And this year in particular, we leaned heavily on focus group information. So we engaged almost 60 people from our community to give us feedback about the data we'd collected through the environmental scanning process. With that information, the staff then does an analysis and a synthesis to help us figure out what are the most pressing issues, where do we think we have a specific opportunity to leverage our resources to make meaningful change, and then we bring that to our board, which represents the community as well, and we set forward a strategic plan for the next 2 years, 2015 and 16.
So when you talk about what the community wants to get done, does it match up with what people want to contribute money for? Do people who donate money also want to address those same things? Or is there ever a bridge that has to be reached between those two things?
For the most part, there's significant overlap. What we find with the donors to the Kalamazoo Community Foundation is that they care about equity, education, and engagement. There are a few issues that they care deeply about that aren't necessarily at the center of our plan. And so as a community foundation, we have to find ways to help facilitate philanthropy in a general sense. But for the most part, we find that when the voice of the community identifies issues, that typically aligns with what our donors are interested in funding as well.
I'll just add a couple of things that I think we've been around now for, it'll be 90 years this August, and we have a community that I think a lot of us know that we have a really extraordinary social sector. So we have nonprofits that have really developed their capacity, and we as an institution as well have grown in our understanding. But the main way we've been doing this work is one organization at a time. And so we have many donors who have affinity for nonprofit organizations, and we think that's really important. One of the points, one of the steps that we think we're going to have to make, though, is in working more collaboratively with these nonprofits. And so an example of that is what we're doing in our education work with the Learning Network, where we're not working with one organization at a time, but we're bringing all these organizations that are focused on shared goals together to develop a shared vision and work together and actually share data so that they're working together towards a community level outcome. And so that is a shift that I think some donors are absolutely supportive of, and some just need to be brought along because we do know everyone's looking for solutions that we and donors, we all know that there's so much in this community, and we think that we can do better.
Well, let's go through these areas that you're focusing on one at a time and talk a little bit about, why these. Let's begin with the idea of equity.
Mm-hmm. Over the last year, we came up with a working definition. And so I'll read it here. Equity is achieved when the social, legal, economic, and other barriers are overcome and all people are able to take advantage of opportunities to live positive lives. We worked hard at that definition because we needed to, one, ground ourselves in what do we mean by equity? We know it can be a lot of jargon. And there are a lot of institutions across the country and in this local community that are now putting equity in as one of their areas of work. And I think that at the heart of it is that we have a growing divide, that the our institutions in the community, us included, that our work has made a positive impact, but we're seeing that it's no match for the scale of the challenges that we see. And so in some ways we think about that, a lot of us were raised on equality, giving everybody the same, right? And that has achieved a lot in for American society, making sure everybody has equal access, equal opportunity. But I think what we're seeing now is that in so many ways that equal opportunity doesn't necessarily give everybody what they might need to overcome the social, legal, and economic barriers that do exist in society. So we're thinking, so equity is forcing us to go beyond equality, to start thinking about other strategies and really be able to get down to the individual level. What do we know about each individual, the assets they bring, their aspirations, and then what can this community pull together to help this person get to take advantage of all the opportunities that are here. So that's one of our grounding kind of definitions. And then second is just our vision statement. We think is in a way what does equity look like to us? And so it's a community where every person can reach full potential. So for us, that's what we're focused on as people. And when they reach full potential, we know great things happen for our community. And we really think that that's in a way what our institution has been about always, which is about creating a community in which everybody's potential can be fully developed and realized.
The issue of wealth and income inequality has become obviously a big national debate to some extent. Is that part of what you're getting at in terms of equity, is that there is this rather large gap? And we can certainly see it here in Kalamazoo. We have some very wealthy people, and yet we also have persistent poverty.
Yeah. It takes shape in so many ways. We get we're a philanthropic institution. We see so many requests. So we see the divides take shape in so many different areas, whether it's for young people in education, whether it's for healthcare, whether it's for housing, whether it's for and housing for all people of all different ages. That in some ways the existing infrastructure of our community, its value is eroding. And it takes a lot of effort just to keep doing next year what we did last year. And so we're seeing that, we're making incremental progress in so many ways. But we think in many ways that we're, the scale of need could never, that we're not going to meet our ambitions, really, of making sure that making life better for all people, or that all people have these opportunities to have their potential fully developed. So we really think we have to rethink how we do these approaches.
And some of the things that we're learning about our approach is that we cannot all succeed until we all succeed. And that when we design programs and strategies that work best for the people who are most vulnerable or are experiencing the most significant challenges, that actually works better for everybody. So when we can pay attention to and truly understand the disparities that exist, whether it's racial disparities in education or income disparities in housing, if we truly understand how to approach that from the most vulnerable perspective, it works better for our community as a whole.
Can you, expand on that a little bit? How does helping the person who is truly, destitute help the person who lives a fairly comfortable lifestyle, mm-hmm. has a mm-hmm. job that is steady, and they make a good wage, they don't worry about the health care benefits and those sort of things? How is that person helped by helping that other person at the bottom of the scale?
Well, I think there's two ways to look at that. One, if you look in the classroom, for example, if you're trying to design educational structure for a student who has entered the classroom 3 grade levels behind. And if you've determined from research and your own best practices that the best strategy for that young person is personalized instruction, the remediation along with the current curriculum and a variety of other strategies, that same strategy is going to work really well for the student sitting next to them, even if they came in at grade level. So to design your approach to help those students who need the most support is not in any way hurting those folks who are coming in at grade level. It helps them too. And then when you think about it from the community perspective, if we have more of our residents contributing to society, paying taxes, earning a wage, taking care of their family, giving back with their volunteer time and their resources, that means that this community has greater quality of life for all. So if you look at it from, you know, the person sitting next to you and how the community benefits as a whole, I think you can see it in both those perspectives.
I'll add that for our institution, we've been thinking about equity and understanding that some of our processes have been accessible to some. And so, for example, our grant application, that we used to have a process that was that people could call in for and for, you know, for people who knew us. We now have a letter of inquiry process that we think is getting to better equality, meaning that it's the same starting point for everybody. And what we're now pressing ourselves into thinking about is, okay, who's able to access us now? But when we apply this idea of equity, it's now saying, well, who's never going to come to our door? And so then we get to our strategic plan element of engagement, meaning that we have to actually go out and engage with people. And when we learn how to become that flexible, we think that we can serve all, right? Then we know that there's some people are going to come in this way, but can we demonstrate, can we be as adaptable as we need to be as an institution to find out, you know, who to solve a problem, who needs to be here, and for us to go and demonstrate all the different types of engagement activities that need to be done to do that.
When you also picked these areas, equity, education, engagement, did you see all three of them as being connected and that addressing one will help in some way addressing the other two?
Yes, we have debates actually internally about which one leads because they all three work so collaboratively together. So when we think about equity, we know that this is a real pressing issue within our community to ensure that those who are most vulnerable, who are experiencing the most significant barriers, really have an opportunity to prosper. And we know that education is the best path for prosperity. When we can educate our community, we have an opportunity to really elevate the quality of life for all. And we can't do either of those things without the engagement of our community and without being engaged in our community. So the three really work in concert together. And so they settled in as our big three goals because that we couldn't do one without the other. And if we can be successful in all three, we think that's going to help us truly achieve that vision of every person reaching their full potential in Kalamazoo County.
I'll just add that it also... being able to see the interconnections is also part of a developing capacity to you know, we've been spending a lot of time in systems thinking. And traditionally, philanthropy and, you know, a lot of different systems in the community are looked at as a machine, right? That you try to, there's a problem, you try to fix it with a very simple solution. And we've been spending more time understanding that all these challenges that we see in the community and the opportunities all have, there's potential, they are connected. And with more relationships, we can see those connections and then and actually bring people together who are natural partners who right now might see themselves as either competitors or just simply in a different, you know, different line of business. But so we're trying to play our role in part, as part of our engagement work to play the role of convener, where we're able to see connections that sometimes people, you know, donors or grantees or other community partners aren't able to see. So that's one of the other assets that we can take greater advantage of.
So what's next? Someone who hears this interview and says, okay, it sounds interesting, sounds like the people at the Kalamazoo Community Foundation have some good ideas. What should they be looking for in terms of seeing that there is progress being made?
I think when you look at equity, education, and engagement, you will see a synchronicity in the work that the Kalamazoo Community Foundation does in 2015 and 16. As we said, they're all connected. So when we approach our work in education, we're going to be bringing questions about equity, disparities, and systemic barriers so that we and our community can understand why we're not getting traction on some of these deeper issues. You'll also see us bring questions about engagement. Where's the community in these conversations? Do we have all the perspectives present at the table as we start to define and solve problems? And I think you'll start to see some more specific work around equity, engaging people in the community to talk about what collaborative work will look like for Kalamazoo if we're truly going to get at this issue of equity.
That's great. what I loved about what Carrie was saying, which I think is different, is we think we need to be prompting questions. that get to more of the structural challenges that we face in this community. But also we think potentially questions are more mobilizing. They bring more diverse people together than saying, here's the solution. And, you know, with that, you know, with more voices, more diversity, we think we're going to get to better ideas and solutions. But we think asking, prompting questions and facilitating those conversations is a really great next step for us.
I think you'll also continue to see specific actions within the learning network. So as we mentioned, our focus on education and the tool of the learning network is really our best demonstration of these new capacities and our attention to this community leadership work. So as the learning network continues to move forward, the Kalamazoo Community Foundation will continue to be central in that leadership work. We're continuing to support the backbone of that collaborative, and we're continuing to push forward on community level outcomes. And so hopefully we'll be able to see more action networks in the community organizing around those specific community level outcomes, like kindergarten readiness, like college and career readiness, like adult learning.
Thank you both for your time. Appreciate it.
It's a pleasure.
Carrie Pickett-Irway is the president of the Kalamazoo Community Foundation. Suprateek Stoats-Ghosh is the foundation's vice president for community investment. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Last week, the Federal Communications Commission voted to approve classifying broadband internet service as a utility. That decision, known as net neutrality, is seen as a win for the digital industry and a defeat for large broadband providers like Comcast. We're going to try to figure out what that means for the industry with Rick Gershon. He's professor of communication and co-director of the Telecommunications and Information Management Program at Western Michigan University. Rick Gershon, thank you for being here.
Good to be with you, Gordon.
Let's begin with the basic definition here. What is net neutrality?
Well, the term net neutrality refers to the basic freedom that all users of the internet enjoy in terms of accessing and providing content. Net neutrality presupposes a neutral and steady playing field with easy on-ramps. And in principle, it prevents cable operators, telephone carriers, and other internet service providers from blocking content or deliberately slowing down any part of the network for business reasons. In sum, all internet traffic should be treated equally, regardless of that information's point of origin or destination.
Is that the rules that we have been operating under for as long as any of us have been using the internet?
I think so. I think that basically, you know, like many new technologies, the internet kind of evolved of its own. But I think there was just kind of a general recognition that this was sort of the fair way to play and that basically everybody should have access to it in whatever way is possible. But as more and more enhanced services have come into play, you know, the rules of engagement have gotten a lot more complicated. And so when you're talking about various kinds of wireless devices, when you're talking about video streaming over the internet, when you're talking about television programming and over-the-top services, now suddenly it's no longer the internet from 10 years ago.
And is video streaming perhaps the real crux of this debate, that it has become much more common to stream video? That's what takes the most broadband, the most bandwidth to actually accomplish. And is that really where this debate is centered around?
I think it's a combination of things. I think it's the video streaming is certainly a big piece of it, because the likes of a YouTube or Hulu or Netflix has definitely increased the amount of data traffic that follows, you know, an internet service provider. And there's no question that in the evening, you know, Netflix represents, you know, 60% of what people are using the internet for, you know, on a given evening. And then you also have the issue of mobile wireless, because when you're talking about the likes of an iPad or your cell phones, again, all of this is internet stuff that's basically being used for the transport of data, voice communication, and what have you. So I think, you know, as internet service providers look at the issue of how do they want to go about conducting their business and maintaining services, I think it's become a much more robust, you know, conversation about how to proceed in the future.
If an internet service provider looks at Netflix and they say, okay, you're taking up a lot of our bandwidth because you're streaming video and other services are not. With net neutrality, right now, is there any room for negotiation between those two entities, or does the internet service provider just have to accept the fact that Netflix is going to use more of that bandwidth because they are streaming video and original programming, those sort of things?
Well, that's really the whole point about reclassifying the idea of broadband under Title II. When the FCC made their decision last week to reclassify, they're really, in effect, treating internet service provision as a common carrier service. And what that really means in practical terms is that they're more like the telephone company of old. And so the idea, of course, is that when you are now operating as a common carrier, you can't discriminate against your users. You have to basically just patch through the service exactly as it's being presented to you. So the cable operator or the telephone carrier who's basically delivering this service doesn't have the wherewithal to sort of make decisions about content delivery or speed or anything. Their job is just simply to, you know, deliver the service as it's being given to them. Now, they can make an argument and say, you know, we're going to charge you more because you are requiring more physically, more of our services in terms of delivery, a little bit like business services were in the days, you know, in the old days of telephone, where you're talking about business versus residential service. You can probably do that. But in this case, you're really saying you can't discriminate against the people who are delivering the service or the end user. And that's also part of the reason why I think business is a little bit, you know, the Verizons of the world and the AT&Ts are very concerned about that, because they lose a lot of control over, you know, how they can charge for this and how they are to deliver these services. I'll give you an example. Historically, you know, your classic example of a common carrier is the post office. So you pay for postage, and in theory, the post office is obligated to then send your letter wherever you're sending it to. So long as you pay for the postage, the post office can't get involved with the actual physical content, and their job is simply to deliver. Well, that's really what you're looking at in this scenario. But the whole point is telephone like internet. And, you know, in a very, very famous case called NCTA versus Brand X Services, you know, back in 2005, you know, the courts were asked to consider that, and they basically regulated, or they basically made a decision about broadband as being an enhanced information services. And so now what we've done is we've gone back and re-regulated, or we're really in thinking about re-regulating internet as though it were a telephone service under this common carrier regulation. And I think that has a lot of people thinking that it's a step backwards. And to a certain extent, there's some truth in that, in the fact that, you know, part of the challenge with regulating high-speed internet services like any enhanced information services is that the regulation can't keep pace with the technology. You know, a good example of that is where you're dealing with digital rights management. The laws on the books are so antiquated in comparison to where we really stand with digital rights issues, you know, in terms of, you know, online music and stuff like that. The telephone industry, the Verizons, the AT&Ts of the world would say, you know what, this kind of regulation is a little bit a step backwards. And it's interesting, because one of the reactions of Verizon when the FCC voted in that 3-2 decision to promote net neutrality was to respond by sending, I think it was that they sent a note to the FCC on a typewriter. They typed out their answer and then sent it in Morse code as well, their way of letting everybody know that they didn't think that this was a step to the future, but a step backwards.
Stepping back here for a moment and looking at the history of regulation, has the internet as we've come to know and use it as consumers really been the Wild West? I mean, has it been lightly regulated, unregulated? I mean, how would you classify to someone who examines this so regularly?
I think that for a long time, it's really been the Wild, Wild West. We've just kind of let it sort of develop of its own accord. You know, and it's gone through various stages of evolution from the days when it was first sort of, you know, created as part of the Department of Defense, you know, going back to the 1960s and 70s. But I think the thing is that, you know, today, of course, it's a very robust network. We certainly, you know, try to keep a very light touch to regulation, and rightfully so. I think there's some truth and value in that. But I think the rules of the game are changing, and I think as more and more complex services come into play, you know, wireless communication, and as we said, video streaming and mobile wireless, you can't just sort of let things just continue as they are, because sooner or later they are going to come to a head. At some point, you do have to take a little bit of a preventative approach, so that at some point, when you get into some serious congestion issues, as an example, when you think about wireless communication and the use of downloading Facebook onto your phone, or you're basically downloading Netflix, you know, onto your iPad, that takes up an enormous amount of electromagnetic spectrum, of which we don't have a lot of. And so the idea that you're just going to kind of keep going along as we have in the past is just not sustainable. So I think that there's a real need, a real value in taking a hard look at this question. But the reality is that people do deserve a very, very unfettered, robust, neutral playing field. There shouldn't be a sense of the ISP trying to make judgment calls as terms of, you know, preferred lanes, speed lanes versus what everybody else gets, because I think there's a potential danger in that. And I think the argument has been made sometimes that the people who are the real entrepreneurs would not be the entrepreneurs that they are today if they suddenly were dealing with a two-tier system. There's those for the fast lanes, for those who can afford it versus those who cannot. So I think we're at best much better for having a more neutral playing field. On the other hand, I think there needs to be a greater public recognition that this isn't free. I mean, you have to have these companies that do provide the services need to have the wherewithal to create services that make financially make sense.
A piece in Wired magazine by a guy named Jeffrey Main, who was very critical of the FCC's decision. But let me just read you this part of it here, where he says, competition on the internet is constantly evolving and poorly understood. AOL was a has-been before the ink was dry on the relentless complaints about its unassailable monopoly. Cable content is suddenly challenged by streaming. DSL was once thought dead, but now offering high-speed service. And I guess I'm wondering here, does he have a point that regulations are always going to be sort of shooting at a very quickly moving target, that this is going to be changing as we go, and therefore that regulations as they exist may become quickly outdated?
Well, I think there's a certain element of truth to his argument. I mean, sometimes we try to regulate things before we really understand the problem. And I think the examples that he cites are very reasonable, because sometimes we assume that these great monopolies are going to be monopolies forever. You know, there was a time when Microsoft was the evil empire, but they're no longer any bigger or worse than any number of other companies. And the same is true for a lot of other companies. Now, suddenly Google has become sort of in the crosshairs of a lot of people, but this too shall pass. And so I think there's a sense that when you try to regulate companies kind of in mid-process, that you sometimes run the risk of overshooting the mark. And as I said, you know, and the argument I would use is a little bit, as I said earlier, about digital rights management. We want to regulate digital media, but the thing is, the truth is that it's moving much faster than regulation can kind of keep pace. So I think, you know, his point is that I think we need to keep a light touch with this sort of thing so that we don't overextend ourselves, overshoot the mark before we really understand how this thing is going to really unfold.
This is probably very unfair, but if you had to take a guess as we sit here right now and say 5 years into the future, what sort of things will we be debating in terms of government regulations and the legal framework around digital communications? What would be your best guess right now?
I think that this issue of net neutrality is, you know, we haven't seen the end of it. I think we're going to see a version of it for sure. I think there'll be a little bit more opportunity given back to the internet service providers in terms of how they regulate, you know, internet speed and delivery. The thing we forget, for example, is that, you know, you have as a consumer the right to pay different delivery speeds. So already you're already exercising that right. We know that in the interstate highway system, we have a situation where people do pay different, you know, freight fees and different rates for whether they're a large truck vehicle versus residential car. We see it also in terms of electricity. We see it in terms of the telephone industry between business users versus residential users. So this idea is not without some precedent in terms of there being differentiation made between them. But I think the concern, of course, insofar as the internet is concerned, is really just making sure that people have equal access and opportunity. And as long as you can provide that, as long as people have a good valued service, I think that people will be willing to take on some of these other extras along the way.
Rick Gershon, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Gordon. It's been fun.
Rick Gershon is a professor of communication at Western Michigan University. He is also the co-director of the Telecommunications and Information Management Program. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.